Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and this week we're looking at disputes between states and international investors. How are they resolved, and why should every one of us care about them? Hello, my name is Alan Rennick, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. This week, we're exploring a piece of research that delves deep into a 70-year dispute between the British and Soviet governments. In the wake of the 1917 Russian Revolution, the new Bolshevik regime, keen to destroy the power of global capital, expropriated the commanding heights of the Russian economy and repudiated a mountain of foreign debt incurred by the Tsar. That action left thousands of international investors out of pocket, but addressing their claims proved exceptionally hard. Only in 1986, in the era of Thatcher and Gorbachev, did the British and Soviet governments finally reach a settlement, and other Western powers agreed resolutions later still. The story of this episode is fascinating in itself. It also sheds new light on how disputes between states and international investors are resolved today. Those disputes rarely hit the headlines, but it turns out that they can be incredibly important for all of us. Now, they're resolved today in very different ways from in the 1980s, but the modern methods face severe criticism, not least from experts and campaigners who argue that they can impede action on climate change. And looking back into history gives fresh perspective on what the problems may be. Well, Lauge Paulsen, who is Professor of International Relations and Law here in the UCL Department of Political Science, is co-author of the study on the Russian case and also the expert on disputes between states and investors. He's currently chair of an intergovernmental program at the OECD examining climate change and investment law. Previously, he served as specialist advisor to the International Trade Committee in the House of Commons. He was advisor to the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office from 2017 to 2020, and he was appointed OBE in 2022 for services to UK trade policy. So, Lauge, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics. It's fantastic to have you on. We've been wanting to have you on for a long time, but you're a busy person.
Thank you, Alan. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Before we dig into the paper on the Russian case, which really is fascinating, I should say, could we maybe just step back for a moment? So when we talk about disputes between foreign investors and governments, what sorts of things are we talking about and how are these disputes resolved?
Well, the disputes are essentially the same sorts of disputes that you and I or companies can have under domestic law with our own government. In the extreme, this could be expropriation disputes. So the government takes over your assets, whether it's your mine or your factory or your farm. Or it could be a whole range of other types of disputes involving government regulation in the context of licensees, in the context of subsidies, or in some contexts, losses as a result of war, losses as a result of civil strife, contract disputes. Whatever you can imagine where an investor that is foreign-owned runs into a dispute with its host state government, that's what we would usually consider to be a foreign investment dispute.
And how are they resolved? What's the process?
Well, there's a range of ways that foreign investors can seek to resolve their disputes. They can go through domestic courts. They can try and resolve their disputes through contractual mechanisms. In some cases, they might have insurance available, so-called political risk insurance. But there's another mechanism which has become particularly important over the last couple of decades, which is where a foreign investor relies on a so-called investment treaty to pursue an international claim against the host government using international arbitration. That's sometimes referred to as investor-state dispute settlement. And that's what most of my work to date has focused on. Not what we're going to talk about today, I think, primarily, but some of my past work, at least.
And just explain, so treaties, are we talking about a big international treaty, one big treaty that governs all of these things, or are we talking about lots of little treaties on individual matters?
No, we're talking about lots of little treaties. So we're talking about a network of bilateral agreements entered into over the last many decades to protect foreign investment. They were signed and ratified mainly between developed and developing states, but we also have a number of such treaties in place that govern foreign investment between OECD jurisdictions. And they all include substantial protections against various forms of political risk, and modern agreements also allow for this arbitration mechanism I just mentioned, which is what gives them their power and potency, if you will.
And that arbitration takes place through tribunals rather than through court systems. It takes place through tribunals.
That's right. So if you're a foreign investor and you're protected by one of these agreements, you do not have to set foot in domestic courts. An international claim directly against your host government, you don't have to go through domestic courts. You don't have to ask your own government for permission. You appoint an arbitrator. The host government appoints an arbitrator, and you try and agree on a third. And those three arbitrators will then have the ability to make a ruling as to the merits of the case. And if they find that there's been a breach, they can issue financial compensation to the foreign investor. There's no appeal, and the decision can be enforced around the world.
And why has this system become so controversial of late?
I think it's controversial in part because of its potency. This is, in a sense, the most potent corner of international economic law, maybe even international law in general, underwriting economic globalization. And it has remarkable breadth in terms of the amount of sovereign acts, government regulation, court decisions, legislative matters that are covered. And the way in which these disputes are resolved is also controversial. So it's through international arbitration where the tribunal members will often, not always, but often be private lawyers with no possibility for appeal. And the ability of private lawyers to tell a government that it should pay, say, £1 billion in compensation for its decision to phase out fossil fuel, decisions like that are inherently controversial, particularly when the decisions are made against jurisdictions that we would otherwise expect to protect property rights and be rule of law jurisdictions. So when you have international tribunals set up under this mechanism that offer foreign investors protections that in some respects go beyond what they can expect in domestic law, then that provides, I think, the foundation for something that is quite controversial. At one point, when these issues were particularly controversial in the context of an agreement being negotiated between the European Union and the United States, the so-called TTIP agreement, the then trade commissioner in the European Commission said that ISDS, that is Investor-State Dispute Settlement, ISDS had become the most toxic acronym in Europe.
And can you give any particular examples just to illustrate the sorts of issues that are raised?
Right. So in terms of the amount of compensation, we have a number of claims, particularly in recent years, where tribunals have told governments that they should pay hundreds of millions, occasionally billions of dollars in compensation to foreign investors. So, for instance, in one case involving Pakistan, a foreign company, a mining company, received an award by the tribunal telling the Pakistani government that it should pay $6 billion in compensation, which was equivalent to the entire IMF bailout package to the Pakistani government that year, that essentially, according to the tribunal, had to be handed over to a single investor. An investor, by the way, who was seeking to operate a mine, but a mine that had never actually opened. Another example, closer to home, is when a British incorporated company received 240 million euro in compensation for a denial of license for offshore drilling in the northern parts of Italy. Again, this was a measure that was, as you alluded to in your introduction, taken for climate change reasons or at least environmental reasons. And I think we should not expect such extensive compensation to be available had a similar claim been pursued in domestic courts, even in the UK. Yet it was a claim brought by a UK investor based on a treaty that the UK government had entered into. Incidentally, a treaty that the UK government last week announced it was going to leave, in part because of climate change concerns.
And you want to just unpack that a little bit further. So why is it exactly that these treaties are leading to such conflict with action on climate change?
Well, to the extent that action on climate change impacts the assets and profitability of, say, fossil fuel companies, and those companies are protected by one of these agreements, they can decide to take their claim outside of a domestic legal system and instead pursue an international arbitration claim against the government taking the climate change measure and ask for a financial remedy, that is, financial compensation. And if the tribunal finds that the measure, while it may be legal under domestic law, while the measure, if the measure breaches the investment treaty, well, then it has, in principle, the authority to tell the government that it should pay significant amounts in compensation to, say, a fossil fuel company. And the concern, of course, not just from NGOs, the civil society movements, or even some governments, but also IPCC itself, has been that the amount of compensation that fossil fuel interests can potentially receive through this mechanism could increase the costs of aligning with the Paris Agreement and achieving net zero.
Proof that all of this really does matter to every one of us. Laga, that's given us really great context for understanding the particular study that we're looking at here. We've been describing there how things are done now, but previously things were done differently, including in the time when the Russian dispute that you examine in the study was resolved. So how were disputes resolved before this system of international tribunals took a leading role?
Well, if we go all the way back to sort of the 18th and 19th centuries, sort of the age of empire, well, then investment disputes would be resolved either within the context of imperial courts or imperial jurisdictions or through gunboats, right? So capital exporting states would send their army to assist when their investors or exporters were in distress abroad. But of course, that was no longer possible after the end of the empire, after the end of the Second World War in particular. And so instead, governments sought to resolve the claims through diplomacy. This was when investors couldn't resolve the claims themselves, that is, but when they couldn't, they would ask their own government for help. And so a British bondholder or asset holder would ask the British government if it could please assist in trying to retrieve some compensation from a state that had expropriated it or otherwise mistreated it, according to the investor. It would ultimately depend on that investor's own government to pursue the claim vis-a-vis the other government. And so diplomacy was really the key mechanism, dispute settlement mechanism, that was available before this sort of rise of modern investment arbitration.
So that means that it's kind of an intergovernmental process. It's not the state and, through lawyers, the investors themselves who are engaged in some kind of process. It's states engaging with other states.
That's exactly right. So the really unique thing about how investment disputes are settled today is that investors can pursue these claims directly through international arbitration without the involvement of their own government. And before that mechanism was made available to them through these agreements or through these treaties, they had to ask their own government to essentially raise what was before a private claim up to an international claim between two states. So this was interstate dispute settlement, if you will, rather than investor-state dispute settlement.
Let's then go to Russia in 1917 and get into this fascinating case study of how these processes operated. So do you want to just introduce us to the study, first of all? What was it that happened in 1917? What are the questions that you're asking in relation to it? And how do you go about researching this case?
Right. Well, in 1917, we had the Russian Revolution. Mm-hmm. And an important pillar of the Russian Revolution, the sort of the economic pillar, if you will, was to repudiate the mountain of debt that the imperial regime had amassed. That was sort of one part of the economic pillar of the revolution. The other part of the economic pillar was expropriation, of course, not just of domestic firms and interests, but also foreign ones. And the debt issue was particularly important because the Tsar, or the imperial regime, left something like £3 trillion worth of public debt to the Bolsheviks. A lot of this was from the First World War. This was a war that the Bolsheviks themselves opposed. And then another part of this, of course, was the war against the Bolsheviks themselves in the context of the Russian Civil War. And so when Lenin took over, he repudiated that debt and said it was not the responsibility of the Bolshevik regime to pay for the debt of the Tsar. So in legal terms, the Bolsheviks were not successors to the imperial regime in the context of the debt. And that left incredible liabilities with foreign investors, foreign bondholders, particularly in France, including many pension holders, but also in other major capital exporting states, including the UK. And as you noted in the introduction, that then triggered negotiations between Moscow and, in the case of our paper that was published last year, London. And those negotiations took place for almost 70 years. And the dispute is often referred to as the longest and most complex sovereign debt dispute in history. And it was that dispute that we sort of sought out to understand and trace in our work.
And just before we get into the findings, tell us a little bit more about the research process. How do you actually practically find out what was being done through all of these years of negotiations?
Archival work. So you can imagine tracing negotiations taking place during most of the period of the Soviet Union's existence involved a mountain of archival files. And it took years to trawl through them. I had the added benefit, however, that my co-author, Eileen Densa, was the one who actually clenched a deal with the Soviets in 1986. So if anyone was well-placed to help write up this saga, it was Eileen.
Fantastic. Let's then get into the findings. I mean, you alluded there to the fact that this took almost 70 years to resolve. Why did it take so long? What was going on?
I think a core reason was, well, it sort of alludes a little bit to what we were talking about in the introduction. Investors, bondholders themselves could not just take their claims directly to an international tribunal that had the power to make enforceable decisions. They relied on their own government. They relied on diplomacy. And the UK, on its part, had no real leverage over Moscow. The main source of leverage that the UK had was that there were significant Soviet assets, or Russian assets, sitting in UK bank accounts. And it was theoretically possible, and it was considered, to take over these Russian assets and use them to pay compensation to British investors and bondholders. Just incidentally, like today, there is significant amounts of Russian assets that has been frozen, and there are currently discussions about whether and to what extent they can be used to fund the Ukraine war reconstruction. But this was there was a similar set of considerations up through the 20th century in London with the Bank of England, with the Treasury, the Foreign Office. But the conclusion time and again was that taking over those assets and using them unilaterally would send a very awkward signal to international markets, perceiving London to be a safe haven for international capital. But without being able to do that, the UK really had very little leverage. And then there was a second issue that was important, and I think particularly interesting, or at least to us, and that was that the UK had different competing objectives in the context of the dispute. So of course, particularly early on, the interests of bondholders, the interests of British investors were important, but they were only part of sets of considerations, obviously, that the UK government would have vis-a-vis Moscow. And specifically, the UK's balance of payments difficulties meant that trading interests and the need to export was far more important in Whitehall. And that made it quite difficult for British asset holders to convince the government that it should press for their claims, because in doing so, it might impede London's ability to negotiate market access with the Soviets. And so there was very little that the UK could do, and in fact was even willing to do, to push for these negotiations in sort of a very robust way, if you will.
And how many investors are we talking about here? Were they a kind of electorally significant body of people, or were, from the government's point of view, were they just irrelevant in that sense?
They weren't that important. As I mentioned, in the context of in France, there were a lot because it was sort of millions of pension holders as well. In the UK, you had a number of banks that, of course, were particularly exposed. Shell was particularly exposed, and a number of other UK companies. But while it was important for those investors, existentially important for some of them, in the grand scheme of things, from the UK government's perspective, it wasn't a critical component, even of its economic relations with the Soviets. And as a result, there was a limited sort of political appetite to robustly push or even espouse for those sorts of claims. And there was also, there was a third issue that was, that proved difficult or at least awkward for the UK government, and that is that Russia itself had potentially a legitimate counterclaim against the UK government, because after the end of the revolution and after the end of the First World War, the UK government decided to stay back in Russia and essentially intervene in what was then a civil war. And the UK, along with its allies, imposed very significant damage on the Russian economy. And this was arguably illegal, that sort of intervention in a civil war. So in the context of discussions for international claims involving compensation, the Russian argument very early on was that if the UK was serious about pursuing compensation discussion, Russians would insist to also bring up possible compensation for UK illegal intervention in the Russian civil war. And the amount involved in the Russian claim was far greater than the losses incurred by British investors.
And how would those claims of legality fit in with the diplomatic process that you've described? And would there have been some kind of legal process as well that the Russian government could, or the Soviet government could have triggered?
No, I mean, just like there were generally no international courts and tribunals sort of that were available in general for investors to pursue their international claims, it was the same when it came to sort of international public law disputes involving intervention. Even today, there's very limited ability to adjudicate these things. But of course, in this context, the UK had the added advantage that while Russia could in theory have consented to adjudicate these claims through international adjudication, that was not something Moscow was interested in, given its mistrust, I think, in sort of its perception of bourgeois international law and procedure.
I guess I'm just trying to get a sense here of what determines the power of different parties in this kind of diplomatic process, and to what extent is it a matter of the amount of money that's at stake on the different sides, the power of the actors domestically to exert political pressure, to what degree does legality make a difference? Just trying to get my head, I mean, this is all very new to me, so trying to get my head around how power is actually created and exerted in this process.
I think one way to respond to that, somewhat difficult question, Alan, but one way to respond to that, I think, is again to compare with the regime we have today. According to its proponents, one of the core benefits of having these sorts of claims and disputes resolved through international adjudication is that, with a cliche, you remove power from the equation, right? You replace power with the rule of law and procedure. And the concerns, I think, from many modern arbitration practitioners and academics is that the way the disputes were resolved during the Cold War, and of course before then as well, was that at least part of the way they were resolved and the likelihood that they were going to be resolved and the outcomes of the settlements were in very significant part up to the diplomatic relations and assets and relative power relations between the parties, just like any other international negotiation, any other international settlement, also outside of the economic sphere. Ultimately, it came down to what was the leverage on both sides. And in this case, the UK had very little.
Let's explore the further implications in a little bit, but we should finish off the story of the case before we get there. So you've described the situation in which the UK had very little leverage in order to get the Soviets to negotiate and agree a deal. But a settlement was agreed in the 1980s. What changed? What led the Soviets to agree a settlement?
Right. So in the early 1980s, 1983, Thatcher initiated sort of a reset in Britain's policy towards the Soviet bloc and found it important to try and support the reforms that Gorbachev was initiating in Moscow. Gorbachev, on his part, was facing falling revenue from oil exports, and this was a real problem because it meant that he desperately needed access to international financial markets to fund his economic reforms, to fund perestroika. And that suddenly gave the UK, the Bank of England, the leverage they had lacked before, because they could freeze out, and they had frozen out, the Soviet Union from access to bond markets in London. And now Gorbachev needed to raise international capital. London was crucial. And so he and Thatcher both decided it was time to maybe put this source of friction behind them.
And what was the settlement?
Well, the settlement was that the assets that had been frozen by the UK belonging to Russia were unfrozen and used to pay remaining British investors. Remember, this would often be children, in some cases grandchildren of individual claimants, but also some firms. And this was about £60 million. So this was nothing, right? Catering for inflation, this was about 2%, 1%, 2%, 3% of the debt. And again, this was almost 70 years after the actual repudiation and expropriations had taken place. Right? But then in return, Russia agreed in the agreement to waive its counterclaim for UK's illegal intervention in the Russian Civil War. And that was very significant because, again, if we cater for inflation, that would potentially have been a claim for 20, 25, maybe even 30 billion pounds that was waived, right? So when we look at the balance of the agreement, there was very little in the end that was available to British investors and bondholders. But from the perspective of the UK government, it managed to achieve, I think, what they rightly saw as a balanced outcome, where while there was not much left in the end for British asset holders, on the other hand, the UK government did not have to pay very substantial amounts of compensation to the Russian government for the intervention in the Civil War. And on that latter point, I think this was one of the things that surprised me a little bit in the process of the research. We found in the archives a note from 1924 from Sir Cecil Hurst. Now, Sir Cecil Hurst was then foreign legal advisor in the Foreign Office, but then he later became a judge and then president on the Permanent Court of International Justice. So he wasn't just anyone. And he concluded in a note in 1924 that we found that the UK's intervention in the Russian Civil War was, in fact, probably illegal. And the same conclusion was reached internally again by Denza, my co-author, when she was with the Foreign Office in the 1970s. And this is quite significant because it shows that if we didn't understand the nature and legality of that counterclaim by the Russians, we would probably have concluded that the settlement in the 1980s between London and Moscow was deeply unfair, deeply unbalanced, by essentially offering very little in these, you know, billions of claims, and there was hardly anything paid in the end to British investors. But the fact that the agreement balanced those claims against another type of claim, another set of interests, makes it, I think, quite an interesting outcome, not just in a political and economic context, but also legally.
I mean, it sounds to me like one could say that it was fair in interstate terms. There was a balancing of the competing claims of the different governments. But from the perspective of the individual investors, this sounds incredibly unfair. And firstly, they got no kind of justice for 70 years. And then when finally some form of justice was served up, it was very meagre in terms of the amount of compensation.
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt that from the perspective of individual bondholders and investors, the sorts of substantive and procedural rights that they have today are much, much greater than what was available at the time. But again, those are rights and avenues that have been made available to them by states through these agreements. So ultimately, it is still governments at the end of the day in international law that decides which rights should foreign investors have and which should they not have? What amount of compensation should they be due and what should they not be due? How should we consider balancing interests, balancing legal arguments, and how should we not consider them? Those are questions for governments to decide. And the way they have decided them today is to negotiate a network of thousands of treaties that focus only on investor interests.
So governments have given a lot away, in a sense, and they've done that presumably for good reason. And what has motivated governments to make that change? And what's the state of the current debate around this as to whether perhaps they've gone too far in acknowledging investor claims? Where are we now in the debate about possible reform?
In a bird's-eye perspective on this is that essentially, capital exporting states initiated these agreements in order to provide better protections for foreign investors when they operated in risky jurisdictions around the world. And up through the 1980s and 1990s, early 2000s, they combined those protections with this dispute resolution mechanism that we talked about initially.
And is this because governments are wanting to attract foreign investment into their own countries, or is it because they're wanting to protect their own investors in other countries?
It's both, right? Uh-huh. So most of these agreements were traditionally negotiated between sort of your traditional capital exporting state on the one hand and a capital importing state on the other. The capital importing state would typically have signed up to the agreements in the belief that it would help them attract foreign investment by convincing foreign investors and their shareholders that their assets would be safe when they go into jurisdictions like Pakistan or Egypt or Venezuela or Argentina. And on the part of developed states, OECD jurisdictions, capital exporting states, there were several reasons, but one reason that this sort of arbitration mechanism and infrastructure that has been built up over the last couple of decades was seen as potentially useful was so they could avoid getting themselves involved in these sorts of disputes going forward. It was a pain to have to constantly respond to British bondholders and asset holders for 70 years on what they were doing with the Russians. It would be much nicer, cleaner, simpler, and possibly, according to some, fairer if those sorts of claims could be isolated in an international legal procedure and then allow governments and their diplomatic affairs to proceed without having those sorts of investor frictions impair them. And so this perceived need to what some refer to as sort of depoliticize the investment disputes was one out of several reasons why this arbitration mechanism was set up.
And what then should we conclude? What conclusions can we draw from our deep dive into history here, into the Russian case, about these current debates that are going on?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that with any historical work, we should be hesitant and conservative in trying to draw far-reaching policy implications from archival material to sort of current ongoing policy debates. But I think a better understanding of how these sorts of disputes were resolved before the emergence of the modern investment protection regime is interesting, particularly because there is growing calls today to make greater use of interstate dispute settlement mechanisms. And so understanding what that might entail in practice, I think, is important. Both the costs, but also some of the benefits. And in today's investment protection regime, politics, diplomacy, I think I mentioned before, sort of sometimes seen as sort of dirty words, something that's standing in the way of pristine rule of law, procedure, and doctrine. But if we look at the settlement between London and Moscow, it was negotiated by careful international public lawyers. It was settled in a treaty. It was an international public law document. And it was rooted in careful considerations about international legal doctrines, but not just the doctrines dealing with the protection of foreign investment, but also other concerns, such as in this case, intervention in civil wars. But we can imagine all sorts of other areas of law which are often also involved and relevant, not just indirectly, but directly in foreign investment disputes. So you mentioned climate up front, issues relating to the protection of the environment, international environmental law, often international human rights law. These are very important issues that can also come up in foreign investment disputes. However, the regime we have today, in a sense, insulates the interests of the foreign investor. And to some critics, right or wrong, I don't take a position here, but to critics, privileges the rights and interests of foreign investors at the expense of other legitimate interests, whether of human rights victims or the environment or the climate or victims of terrorism or pensioners who've lost all their money because their government went bankrupt, what have you, labor rights and so forth. And so what the diplomatic route allowed for in this dispute and many other disputes during the Cold War was for governments to try and balance out these competing claims and find a pragmatic, forward-looking settlement. And that, I think, some would find that to be in contrast with the way equivalent disputes would be settled today, which is focusing on one part of the picture rather than all of it.
Well, thank you so much, Lager. This, I confess, is a subject that I knew very little about, but you've introduced it to us in a really fascinating way. I've learned a lot and learned just how important all of this is. So I hope lots of our listeners have enjoyed that very much as well. We have been discussing the article Settling Russia's Imperial and Baltic Debts by Eileen Denzer and Lauger Paulsen, published last year in the American Journal of International Law. Full details, as ever, are in the show notes for the episode. Next week, we're looking at a very topical question within UK politics. Do protests affect what politicians say? To make sure you don't miss out on that or other future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics, all you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Google Podcasts, or whatever podcast provider you use. And while you're there, we'd love it if you could take a moment of time to rate or review us too. I'm Alan Rennick. This episode was produced by Alice Hart and Eleanor Kingwell-Banham. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you for listening.